and organically tied to the lived experience of its people. Organic Marxism, effective Marxism, embraces a people's historical traditions, their cultural mores, and their deeper ethical insights as contained in their own wisdom traditions. How will Marxist ecology take root in the hearts of men and women if it is not connected to the cultural and spiritual resources of a particular people and its culture? Chapter 12. The Ecology of Organic Marxism. Exploding the Myth of Unlimited Growth. During most of the 5,000 years since the first great human civilizations emerged, the human drive toward expansion and domination was not a problem for the Earth itself. Although humans gradually dominated other species, our power to disturb the planet was relatively limited. Even 100 years ago, the resources of the planet seemed almost infinite in comparison to human needs. But in the last few decades, things have changed radically. Of course, nature remains powerful, even frightening, in her ability to overwhelm and destroy. The earthquake and tsunami in Japan just a few years ago, which decimated the defenses of a nation that proudly thought it was ready for anything, offer an unforgettable reminder of this fact. Events from space, such as a major asteroid, remain out of our control. Nevertheless, in our lifetimes, something has happened that is unique in the history of this planet. For the first time ever, humanity has encountered absolute limits on growth. You find these limits everywhere you look. Humanity has made itself fundamentally dependent on hydrocarbons, yet we know that the global hydrocarbon reserves are limited, and the environmental cost of burning them all would be disastrous. As a species, we are fundamentally dependent on drinking water. Yet, across the planet, the amount of usable fresh water is decreasing below the population's needs, threatening the lives of hundreds of millions of people. The only thing we need more than water is clean air. Yet, we have transformed the atmosphere of the entire planet. And the list could be extended on and on and on. There is virtually no part of the planet where the hand of humankind cannot now be measured. The deserts of the Sahara, the highest mountain peaks of the Himalayas, the depths of the oceans. The trouble is that the foundations of the Western economic system are based on the fictional assumption of continuous economic growth, which implies the further assumption that natural resources and raw materials are unlimited. As we have just seen, however, the natural resources of this planet are most definitely not unlimited. In fact, most major multinational corporations, including the oil companies, are already calculating backwards from the depletion of the natural resources on which they depend. As growth-based economics increasingly reaches the planetary limits on growth, the chaotic cascades and collapses will only increase in frequency and violence. The social and political consequences of this growing instability are unspeakably grave. With these facts in mind, it's not difficult to see why economic theory may well be the most important topic in discussions of ecological civilization today. Around the planet, the vast majority of economic theories that are influencing world leaders are based on the demand for growth. The whole set of economic arrangements on which current societies and their citizens' lives depend will continue to function only if the global economy continues to expand at something like the current rate. This fundamental axiom of the current system applies to virtually every economic unit, from the macroeconomic patterns of the G20 nations to the economic models on which the multinational corporations depend, to mid-sized companies doing business within a single country, to budgets of cities and states in a given country, and even down to, for example, the shop owner in a small town. And now you see the problem. The entire economic system of the 21st century civilization that humanity has built depends on growth. the very kind of growth that the planet can no longer sustain. There is simply no way around this contradiction. It is as fundamental as any that humans have ever faced. No little tweaks, no minor changes in economic models, no soft touches of government regulation will suffice to abolish the contradiction between our current models of economic success and the planet's limits, which we are now reaching. Only a radically new theoretical framework, like the one we are calling organic Marxism, can bring economic planning back into line with planetary reality. Seeking civilizational change, the philosophy of organism. As we have seen in previous chapters, organic Marxism augments the way Marxism used to be taught. It encourages the updating of Marxian principles as they are grafted with individual cultures. While maintaining the basic values of Marx, organic Marxism insists that the specific categories of his thought need to be adapted as they are transmitted today. The organic sciences are important allies, of course, but traditional values, cultures, and even religious beliefs can also serve as allies in building a postmodern philosophy of organism. If we are to win support for economic alternatives robust enough to counteract the destructive force of global petrocapitalism, we will need to build alliances with all traditions of thought and practice, new and old, that support the movement toward a more just and sustainable society. To embrace a philosophy of organism requires one to make the transition from modern to postmodern categories. Most modern philosophies worked with a logic of exclusion rather than with a logic of organic inclusion. For example, one of the most basic assumptions was that Marxists and religious persons could never work together in harmony. After all, Marx said religion was an opiate that deadened workers' awareness of their real condition. Modernist European Marxism therefore sought to overcome religion in order to revolutionize economic conditions, transform politics, and improve social conditions. Religion, in the era of modernism, was indeed often guilty of supporting colonialism and unjust hierarchies of power. The majority religion of North America, Christianity, tended to transform Jesus' concern for the poor and marginalized into a cultural imperialism. Christendom's intolerance of other religions and ways of life contributed to nationalism, militarism, and xenophobia. Instead of focusing on personal transformation and justice for the poor, as its founder taught, modern Christianity tended to seek power and domination. In a postmodern civilization, by contrast, these oppositions are being re-examined. For example, scholars from China now learn about Western religions, asking whether they can help support the values of an ecological worldview. Many postmodern religious people in America now believe that communitarian philosophies stand closer to the values of the Jewish prophets and to the prophetic teachings of Jesus than the capitalist free market ever did. This is only one example of the new alliances that are possible for organic thinking. As a postmodern worldview devoted to pursuing economic alternatives to global capitalism, organic Marxism builds on the insights of intellectual allies. Whether ancient or postmodern, Eastern or Western, religious or philosophical. Many of these allies are challenging the dominant assumptions of Western modernism and deconstructive postmodernism. The most important ally, in our opinion, is process thought. In the West, process philosophy refers to a major school within philosophy that was originated by Alfred North Whitehead. As we saw in Chapter 10, the core idea of this school is that all life, all existence, and all experience are constituted as and by a never-ending process. Whitehead asserts that it is fundamental to the philosophy of organism that the notion of an actual entity as the unchanging subject of change is completely abandoned. An actual entity is at once the subject experiencing and the superject of its experiences. The ancient doctrine that no one crosses a river twice is extended. no thinker thinks twice, and, to put the matter more generally, no subject experiences twice. For Whitehead, this philosophy of organism has three central implications. 1. Interconnection. Human beings are not isolated units, mere individual atoms. We are always internally related to one another. As Whitehead writes, this internal relatedness is the reason why an event can be found only just where it is and how it is, for each relationship enters into the essence of the event, so that, apart from that relationship, the event would not be itself. It is more true to say that a society or culture or nation constitutes its members than it is to say that a group of separate, discrete individuals comes together to constitute a society, culture, or nation. This view that we are constituted by our relationships is the opposite of individualism, the dominant modern view that each individual is an isolated unit. The West has exported many bad ideas, but perhaps none of these has been as damaging as the idea of individualism. 2. Ever-changing process. The central idea of process philosophy is that nothing is identical across time. Imagine my friend Lynn as a child, a teenager, and an adult. The teenage Lynn is, of course, related to the young girl who she was 15 years ago. But we must not say that the two are identical. The changes in her appearance, her thinking, and her surroundings have been so significant that we can only speak of a resemblance between the earlier and the later state of a person. The same is true for the relationship between Lynn as a teenager and as an adult. Certain patterns of her personality continue to be expressed over time, for example, her intelligence, her graciousness, and her devotion to her family. Still, the process of her life brings constant changes. Nothing stays still. The same is true for you and me. To put it paradoxically, the only thing that remains constant is the process itself. We mentioned at the beginning that process philosophy may be a more natural way of thinking for Chinese people than for Western people. In traditional Western thought, the emphasis was always on unity over time. The Greek philosophers who first established the patterns of Western thought proclaimed that what is real is unchanging. As a result, as Plato concluded in his famous dialogue, The Republic, anything that undergoes change is not truly real. It is in part an illusion. The early Christian thinkers made a similar move. They identified the individual with having an eternal and unchanging soul. All the things about a person that change, her appearance, her culture, and the ever-changing thoughts and feelings that she experiences, are not part of what she really is. Of course, there is a problem here. These changing features of ourselves are what we most value in ourselves and those around us. Process philosophy, by contrast, puts the emphasis back on what is more important to us, the never-ending journey of experience, fresh insights and the maturation of previous thinking, new and deepening friendships, and the growth of character. 3. Holism. In addition to interconnection and ever-changing process, process thinking emphasizes holism. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. This, too, is a deep insight of traditional Chinese thought. In the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu writes, "The master understands the parts because he sees them from the perspective of the whole. Not only does he bring understanding, however, he also brings compassion. We feel compassion for the small child because we understand the adventure that lies before her. We understand this moment in her life from the perspective of the many years of experience that we have acquired. Likewise, the master has compassion for the poor man, the confused person, and even the person who has made a terrible mistake. Why? He can have compassion because he understands the whole range of experience and influences that have brought about the tragedy or the mistake. Wisdom grows out of the perspective of the whole. By contrast, The foolish man can see only the individual moments, his wishes, his momentary desires, his goals at this particular time. Western thought has not been holistic thought. It has often tried to build up to an understanding of the whole, piece by piece. But how can you build the whole if you only know the parts? If you don't understand the shape of the whole that you are trying to actualize, you are like the builder who begins putting together the bricks in front of him without any plan. Soon, he gives up in despair because without a plan, only chaos emerges. The student without a clear plan for her education as a whole has difficulty in organizing her studies. The city officials, without a long-term plan for their city, cannot create a beautiful space for the residents to live in. The nation that does not have a clear vision of the values by which it will live can construct attractive buildings and powerful industries, but it cannot make a lasting, positive impact upon the world. Too often, Western leaders have been myopic, managing their cities and countries one step at a time. They have built some impressive technologies, factories, universities, and scientific achievements. But without a vision for the whole, the individual achievements do not come together into a coherent civilization. The process philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead calls us back to the ancient Chinese wisdom traditions and concepts such as Tian, Qi, and Li, which encourage a holistic perspective. Remember the words from the Tao Te Ching quoted above. The master views the parts with compassion because he understands the whole. Enlightened leaders hold before themselves a more complete vision of the entire system or civilization that they are attempting to actualize. Only from that perspective are they able to choose their individual steps wisely. The Manifesto of Organic Marxism. Ecological civilization represents both a theory and a practice. It has very practical implications for government politics, organizations, and the design of society. These practices are rooted in the philosophy of organism, on the one hand, and in Marxist analysis of the dynamics of class and capital, on the other. Ecological thinking. According to ecological thinking, reality is made up of interrelated events rather than individual, isolated substances. These events, which make up the lives of all living beings and of nature as a whole, have intrinsic value. As a result, one must treat the other always as an end in itself, and never merely as a means. Genuine value lies in each event, in each organic relationship, not in extrinsic factors such as what products can be used for or how much money they fetch in the free market. In ecological thinking, living things are constituted by their relationships with each other and with their ecosystems and social systems. Each participant in these relationships has its own purposes, which must not be disregarded. But even our individual features are developed through interactions with communities. Relations among communities deeply affect the nature of each, which then affects the lives of its members. In this sense, ecosystem studies tend to converge with the Marxian analysis of class, just as atomism in physics converges with liberal individualism. The universe is more than blind chance, unfolding through physical laws. All things have value, and all seek to maximize their value. For living beings, this drive takes the form of the struggle to survive and to thrive. For humans, that drive is also expressed in more complex ways: the desire for beauty, the fear of death, the search for meaning, the quest for love. Knowing this, humans become responsible to actively seek inclusive values, offering to others what we wish for ourselves. Equally, humanity becomes responsible to consider not only human interests, but also the interests of other species as inherently valuable as well. The Manifesto of Organic Marxism. At the heart of the manifesto stand three central claims. Capital justice is not just, the free market is not free, and the costs of global climate disruption will be most severe among the poor. Recognizing these truths, we call on global leaders to reorganize human civilization according to ecological and socialist principles. 1. Capitalist justice is not just. Justice is conceived very differently in capitalist and Marxist theory. Marx writes, "From each according to his ability, to each according to his need." This famous phrase reflects Marx's society-based understanding of what is just. By contrast, the capitalist theory of justice says, "From each according to his wishes, to each according to the market." That is, each person decides which part of the market to invest his time and money in, and how hard to work. Whatever the market then pays him, or doesn't pay, counts as just. As organic Marxists, we blame this capitalist view of justice both for worker inequities and for the growing environmental catastrophe. We now know that the planet itself cannot sustain the payouts that the capitalist system provides to the world's wealthiest 1%, nor the lifestyle of consumption and waste that they buy with their wealth. With Marx, we advocate a system that brings the distribution of resources into harmony with what people actually need to survive, not with their unlimited desires. All the evidence shows that within capitalist systems, the wealthy do not freely redistribute their wealth to the poor. Across virtually every culture, when the wealthiest are able to pocket high profits and decide how to spend their money, they choose luxurious lifestyles and high personal consumption. Only a postmodern socialist order will limit these excesses. The free market is not free. The father of capitalism, Adam Smith, believed that markets are the most rational and moral way to regulate human interactions. According to Laissez-faire Capitalism, Chapter 2, governments are required not to intervene in the markets in any way. Smith even used the metaphor of God. Markets are so good at rewarding the virtuous and punishing the lazy that it is as if an invisible hand were guiding capitalist society. Ironically, Adam Smith's doctrine came to be known as the free market doctrine. As a result, generations of people have confused the freedom of human rights and basic human liberties, a freedom that humans care much about, with the alleged freedom of the wealthy to accumulate as much wealth as they can. Anyone who looks at the world in 2015 with open eyes will recognize that Adam Smith was wrong. Capitalism has created a massive underclass of people whose work is not rewarded with wealth and comfort. The unrestrained pursuit of wealth on the part of those with economic power has left approximately half the world's population, over 3 billion people, living on less than $2.50 a day. The richest 400 families in America possess more wealth than the bottom 155 million Americans combined. The evidence is overwhelming that the wealthiest nations have designed the world economic system to bring maximum gains to themselves. This is not a free market. It is a market of virtual slavery for the increasingly impoverished classes around the globe. It is time for us to rise up and require markets to play the role of servant, not of master. Henceforth, we expect markets to serve a subordinate role, fostering the goal of the common good for the planet as a whole. 3. The costs of global climate disruption will be most severe among the poor. Unless we intervene, climate change will wreak untold suffering on the world's poorest citizens and on a third to a half of animal species. In the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx writes that workers have nothing to lose but their chains and calls them to unite. Marx's call to action has not been without response, as the history of socialism over the last 165 years shows. But Marx's call by itself has until now been insufficient. People in power have enjoyed their physical comfort and the toys that technology provides. By contrast, those stuck in poverty, despite their numbers, have not had the power or the education to overthrow unjust economic and social systems. multinational corporations have been able to unduly influence governments and world leaders, blocking reforms. Unless something significant changes on this planet, it's unlikely that the deadly grasp of global capitalism will be loosened. But significant changes are taking place on this planet. Scientists agree that the effects of climate disruption are becoming increasingly severe. Social and economic systems as we know them are coming under increasing pressure. Many will collapse, along with the governments that are based upon them. The future will not be business as usual. Much can be done. To choose the common good over a wealth-driven economy means implementing the socialist principles that are implied by organic Marxism. It's time for governments to rule for the people, rather than for the wealthy. It's time for transnational agreements to limit the power of multinational corporations, allowing the people to rebuild our societies on the basis of sustainable, steady-state economics. Humanity has two choices. We can begin now to turn away from the myth that it is best for the planet to let wealthy people rule in their own interest, or we can wait until the collapse of capital-based civilization in order to initiate structures that serve the common good. Now, not later, is the time to act. Conclusions. Both ecology and Marxism remind us at every moment to think of the broader web of life to which we belong and on which we depend. Ecologists study how life-sustaining actions work harmoniously within particular ecosystems. Social sustainability is also a matter of balanced webs of interaction. Socialism is the philosophy that aims to foster and preserve this balance. In these last chapters, we have summarized the philosophies of process and relationship that combine ecology and Marxism. One process philosopher, John Cobb, has managed to summarize the resulting worldview in only 10 sentences. He calls it 10 Ideas for Saving the Planet. 1. Reality is composed of interrelated events. 2. There are gradations of intrinsic value. 3. God, understood as the unifying feature of the process, aims at maximizing value. 4. Humans are uniquely, but by no means exclusively, valuable and uniquely responsible. 5. Education is for wisdom. 6. The economy should be directed toward the flourishing of the biosphere. 7. Agriculture should regenerate the soil. 8. Comfortable habitat should make minimal demands on resources. 9. Most manufacturing should be local. 10. Every community should be part of a community of communities. Above all, this worldview emphasizes process. Philosophers have been too quick to abstract from the natural processes of life, reifying instead the individual, the effects of his actions, and the intellectual constructs that he creates. But these are abstractions. The deepest reality is the process itself. What living beings do in their communities at every moment in the process of life, breathing, relating, working, thinking, understanding, giving, participating, is what counts. Abstractions make for beautiful books, filled with lofty ideals. Too often, however, the ideas remain unapplied and inapplicable. Even the authors don't try to live them out. Ideas that matter make a difference in concrete, lived reality, affecting the interactions of people in communities, face-to-face and eye-to-eye, the partnerships that they form, and the work they do together. Ecological civilization is not an abstract philosophy, a mere set of theoretical principles. Marxist thinking has always been focused on moving beyond abstract debates and keeping societal reform at the center of attention. It is about living in the world in a different way. This worldview, which we have labeled organic Marxism, is compelling. Readers across multiple nations and cultures recognize when policies are just and life-giving, and when they are not. It's to the praxis of organic Marxism that we now turn. Chapter 13. The Praxis of Organic Marxism. Some try to argue that Marxism fails as a matter of principle. Thus, critics explain, socialists cannot use Marx to formulate social and economic solutions at the global level, because countries are so different from one another that no universal analysis can be valid. When Marxist concepts are adapted to fit the specific features of a given culture, they respond that Marxist principles are no longer really guiding the economic analysis and the proposals for change. It's no longer really Marxist. This double-edged criticism is one of the two that one hears most often in the West. The other one is that Marxism was already tried and proven false. Throughout this book, we have been challenging the false dilemma that fuels this complaint. Either Marxist theory is completely universal, our critics say, and thus too abstract to be helpful, or it is so modified from Marx that it's not really Marxist anymore. We reject the either-or thinking that underlies this charge. European thinkers in the early modern period were preoccupied with the tensions between universal theories and theories that adapt to the ever-changing contexts of action in the world, which they called relativism. It's part of our postmodern condition, however, to live with the interweaving of general ideas and specific contexts, as messy as this interweaving may be. For a parallel, think of post-colonial theory. Clearly, the nature of colonization and the manifestations of colonial rule varied greatly between Africa, India, China, Latin America, and other countries, which means the struggles around the globe to recover from colonialism are not identical. But common features of our post-colonial condition exist nonetheless. As Childs and Williams write, post-colonialism has an inescapable global dimension, but it does not mean that post-colonial theories are inevitably totalizing in an overweening effort to master and explain everything, totalizing in its bad sense. Explanatory breadth does not include highly adapted forms of microanalysis at the local level. So also with Marxist analysis. We have contended that power is increasingly held and exercised by the wealthiest segment of society, individuals and corporations. Power is not distributed merely through the luck of the draw, person by person. The power hierarchy expresses differential relations between classes. We have also shown that capitalist economics, philosophy, and practice have produced vast inequities and injustices as a byproduct, and that only when societies break the hold of these assumptions can the injustices be overcome. These are general claims. They are in no way weakened when specific socialist reforms are adapted and implemented, organically, to meet the needs of specific cities, countries, and cultures. That multiple open Marxisms are evolving to address the specific context of late capitalism and the growing environmental catastrophe does not falsify Marxism. To the contrary, it demonstrates its continuing usefulness as a social and economic alternative to the capitalist treatment of society and the environment. This chapter moves from the general to the specific. In order to spell out the praxis of organic Marxism, we must first formulate its four central guiding principles and then its specific policy guidelines. Only then can we recommend a series of concrete practices in the closing section. Guiding principles. Four general principles have run like red threads through the preceding chapters. It is now possible to state them clearly and succinctly. 1. For the common good. Most commentators take it as axiomatic that a democracy exists for the sake of the people. After all, the word democracy means rule by the people. And yet the evidence is overwhelming that most democracies in the world today primarily serve to increase the wealth of their richest members. A recent Harvard Magazine article shows how unaware even educated Americans are about the actual wealth disparities in their own country. Few know that over 80% of the wealth in the United States is in the hands of only 20% of the population. By contrast, the poorest 40% of the population possesses, between them, a mere 0.3% of the wealth. Members of this group have an average net worth of $2,200. By the end of 2011, according to the Wall Street Journal, the net worth of the richest 7% of Americans has risen nearly 30% above what it was before the Wall Street crisis of 2008. By contrast, the average wealth of America's remaining 93%, some 111 million households, actually dropped by 4%. It is contradictions such as these that lead David Harvey to write of the end of capitalism in his most recent book. Political renewal begins with reforms that serve the common good. 2. Organic Ecological Framework. Understanding the human situation on this planet means grasping a simple principle. The human species will succeed only as long as we retain a harmony and balance between the human species, the global ecosystem, and other species with whom we share the biosphere. Scholars use the term human exceptionalism for those ideologies that treat humanity as an exception to the natural principles that govern all other life forms on the planet. For centuries, our species derived its values primarily from its own interests, treating other life forms as resources for human gain. Today, however, for the first time in planetary history, these policies have brought about a man-made climate disruption that threatens human civilization as a whole, together with the very biodiversity on which our survival depends. 3. Class matters. The wealthy created, and now profit from, a global economic system that keeps billions of humans below or near the poverty line. Climate change is caused in the first place by the consumption patterns of the wealthy classes, not by the poor. Individual rich people may be nice or mean. Some may even contribute a portion of their wealth toward ecological causes. But as a class, they are the ones who are perpetrating the broken and destructive economic systems. Hence, the solutions will also be class-based rather than class-blind. Corrective policies must move beyond the decisions of individual persons to address class inequities, putting the responsibility for change where it belongs. 4. Long-term holistic perspective. Today, we recognize that unregulated capitalist corporations will pursue the goal of short-term profits for their stockholders, often at great expense to other humans and the environment. We have learned to expect that, when a given market or a country's resources are depleted, multinational corporations will move on to other markets where they can win a higher rate of return for their stockholders. Sometimes, of course, the stockholders of companies vote on behalf of socially responsible policies in small and symbolic ways, which the managers then implement. By and large, however, owners and managers will act to maximize profits for their business. This is the nature of the system. Recall Adam Smith's promise to capitalists that their efforts to maximize profits will always benefit society in the long run, an empty promise that the wealthy continue to make to the poor, as in Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics. In short, one cannot expect a business to exist for the good of the nation's population as a whole. This is simply not its mandate. Business decision-makers seek to ensure high rates of return on their investments year after year. As conditions change or resources are depleted, the business will switch markets or diversify its portfolio to retain competitive profits for its owners or shareholders. One of the clearest examples in recent history has been the oil industry. The trends hold as much for North American firms such as ExxonMobil, with $400 billion in sales in 2012, according to Forbes, as they do for British Petroleum or Royal Dutch Shell. Educated people in all countries are aware that global petroleum resources will eventually run dry, and that conservation, not overproduction, is necessary if the planet is to wean itself from its addiction to oil and petroleum byproducts. Yet the oil companies, racing to increase production in the final years of their industry, are enjoying profits rarely seen in any branch of business. They are also spending huge amounts of money in lobbying Western governments, and especially the United States, to open up new oil fields, to build pipelines, and to overturn regulations and restrictions. One should not be surprised by the behavior of the oil companies and their managers. It's what one should expect. By contrast, one does expect a well-run government to act in the people's interest. The mission of governments is to take a much longer-term perspective because depleting all the resources, agricultural land, rivers and forests, clean air, mineral resources, will leave the next generation of citizens without the ability to survive and thrive. Long-term planning of this sort requires policies for conserving and protecting resources that are based upon an extremely long-term perspective. It is said that the average family can plan for its grandchildren, but has trouble thinking ahead to the needs of their children, the fourth generation. The native peoples of North America, by contrast, have traditionally utilized the seventh generation rule: act in such a way that the net effect of your decisions will be positive for the seventh generation after you, your great-great-great-great-grandchildren. Taking the long-term perspective requires holistic thinking. We do not help even the third generation when our investments in industrialization or in urbanization leave the world so polluted that the cities become uninhabitable, the air unbreathable, and the countryside barren. Profit-based policies are incapable of taking the required long-term perspective. Long-term planning is systemic planning. One views the nation as a whole as a system built out of subsystems. Planning for growth in any one area is done in light of its effects on all other areas that are impacted by that growth. Expectations for profit-taking in the present are reduced in order that more investment can be made in the future. At this point, the government often comes into conflict with business people and business interests within the nation. Their interest in quick profits leads business people to be critical of long-term investments in infrastructure, investments whose payoff may lie many decades in the future. To resist their influence requires firm resolve on the part of leaders who work on behalf of the people and the earth. Their long-term vision will lead them to oppose demands for high personal and business profits in the short term. There are times when short-term GDP growth comes at too great a long-term cost. Yet, the reason for these limits is overwhelming. Only a global civilization built on organic principles is sustainable. The cracks and fissures of unsustainable practices and policies are now visible to observers around the world, and their patterns documented openly in our newspapers and discussed in the streets. Even the United States, where the carbon footprint per person is among the highest in the world, is now establishing regional centers to prepare for the increasing effects of climate change on agriculture and forests. Policy guidelines. The previous chapters suggest three overarching guidelines, which in turn provide the framework for more specific policy initiatives. 1. National interests are no longer the only defining context for government decision-making. In the days when planetary resources appeared to be unlimited, it was rational, if not ethical, for each nation to consume as many resources as it possessed or could take through conquest or control. Today, we know that the planet's resources are dwindling rapidly and must be divided between all nations, as well as between human and non-human populations. In the past, governments negotiated with other nations primarily in order to regulate human commerce, to resolve disputes, and to end wars. In the coming years, by contrast, environmental diplomacy will of necessity rise to the highest priority. Sharing resources, reducing waste, and negotiating international treaties to limit greenhouse gases and other kinds of pollution will become the most important goals for successful statesmanship. For example, water shortages are expected to be the most inflammatory area of environmental dispute in the coming 15 years. Air pollution, fishing rights, and energy policy will also play increasingly urgent roles in international diplomacy. Marx already realized that the fundamental socio-economic issues transcend national boundaries. The global flow of capital may well prop up national governments as long as they serve its needs, but the dynamics of capital transcend any given nation. The solutions, Marx realized, will therefore need to be transnational. By and large, national governments have not seen the plight of farmers, underpaid workers, and the chronically unemployed as urgent enough for them to work together to find solutions. They have also not ceded sufficient power to the United Nations or to any other transnational organization to make significant changes. Initiatives to help the middle class and the poor have therefore been limited to small-scale reforms within the context of current power structures. That era is coming to an end. As climate change brings chronic food and water shortages, the deteriorating situation will bring social unrest that is too dangerous to ignore. Throughout history, masses of hungry and displaced persons have been the most potent source of social instability and revolution, even civilizational collapse. It's idealistic to think that the rich and powerful, governments and multinational corporations, will suddenly feel compassion for the poor and freely choose to redistribute their wealth. More likely, the falling standard of living for the middle classes and their increasing vulnerability will prompt demands for change that are too powerful to ignore. In the best case, systemic changes will come about through treaties and democratic processes. In the worst case, overthrowing the new dynasties of wealth, or what Thomas Piketty calls patrimonial capitalism, will come through violent revolutions and a protracted period of social chaos and economic collapse. Efforts by individual nations will not be sufficient to bring about the global systemic changes that are needed. 2. It becomes increasingly urgent for policies to address the reality that power now falls in the hands of an ever smaller number of people who control more and more of the world's wealth. We have not written this book merely to score academic points. Volumes have been written about why Marx's analyses failed to convince governments, intellectuals, and workers. Some critics cite inadequacies in Marx's historical and empirical work, or theories that they dislike, such as his utopianism or his theory of value. Others attack the doctrines of later Marxist schools of thought, Leninist, Stalinist, Maoist, and many others, which they allege created confusion about the core principles of Marxism. Yet others cite shortcomings in the implementation of Marx's principles by socialist governments, which produced a popular backlash against Marxist political and economic philosophies. Many of these academic discussions miss the point. Marxism criticizes the world's dominant economic system, which allows people to amass as much wealth as they can and to spend it as they wish. Should we be surprised that this critique generates backlash? To acquire things and to use them selfishly is a big part of human nature. Technological advances, the new smartphone, the new app, the new car, make each new toy more enticing and addictive. Today, technology, more than religion, has become the opium of the people. In developed and developing countries alike, people long to acquire more and consume more. The natural drive to produce and to own is not in itself the problem. For most of human history, it served the species well. Consider, for example, the periods when settlers were first moving into virgin territories and needed to rapidly develop farms, cities, and industries. Even in these times, however, governments were necessary to provide restraints, stability, and infrastructure. But the industrialization and technologization of the planet have fundamentally changed the situation. We now recognize that the unrestrained drive to possess and consume has become the motor that is driving an out-of-control global economy toward planetary limits and beyond at an unsustainable tempo. In this new context, steady-state economics, regulatory agreements, reduced consumption, and international collaborations have become essential for the survival of the planet. The days of take what you can get have passed, and capitalism without breaks has become dysfunctional. In today's situation, over-acquisition and over-consumption are a class problem. Class-based analyses became unpopular in the 1950s, when the middle class grew rapidly and reduced the wealth differential of the upper classes. The Cold War mentality did not help either. In the last decades, however, the classes have again been moving rapidly apart. For the world's poor, who are located predominantly in the global south, a middle-class existence has fallen hopelessly out of reach. Likewise, the level of wealth and power of the upper classes now dwarfs that of the middle class, and the gap is growing more and more rapidly. Effective policies will need to address the vast discrepancies in power, wealth, and consumption of the upper, middle, and lower classes. We cannot begin to address an economy spiraling out of control until we make visible the power sources that are controlling it. Thanks to the internet, the data are available as never before. An educated and increasingly disenfranchised middle class will become increasingly vocal about systems that are tilted in favor of large corporations and wealthy families. Again, it is far better for policymakers to begin to address the inequities now than to wait until social unrest begins to arise. 3. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Marx's famous phrase reflects his distributive theory of justice. We saw in Chapter 8 how differently justice is conceived in capitalist and Marxist systems. In the ideal capitalist system, each person decides in what branch of the market to work and how hard. The market will, allegedly, distribute rewards and complete justice according to the person's own intelligence and hard work. If the planet were of infinite size and its resources were unlimited, as Adam Smith assumed, governments would not need to restrain individual consumption. That's why Smith claimed that the capitalism system is just and fair for all. The high profits of your neighbor do not mean that you, or anyone else, will get less. If everyone works hard, everyone will reap more and more from the planet. But Adam Smith was wrong. For virtually every natural resource, water, minerals, agricultural land, forests, even the air we breathe and the average temperature of the planet, scientists can now calculate the approaching limits. Limits produce what economists call a zero-sum game. Higher consumption for your neighbor means lower consumption for you. When the rich grow richer, the poor must grow poorer. Humans do not like to be restrained in how much they can acquire and consume. This explains the preference for limited government restrictions in most societies. But in the zero-sum game, governments are necessary to curb excesses. That's even truer when available resources are approaching their limits. In times of war, famine, drought, and national emergency, people have been willing to submit to limitations for the survival of society. Now, for the first time in history, it is a global emergency that justifies this role of government. Hence the need for policies built on the Marxian principle, to each according to his need. The practices of organic Marxism. How can a more organic Marxism provide specific guidance for responding wisely and appropriately to these challenges? Because governments and economies are structured differently across countries and cultures, policies will vary. Concrete proposals need to be written by those who are experts about the situation in each individual country. Nevertheless, the principles of organic